I'm Bob Harold, and this is the course on Amazing Grace, Stories of Grace Today. So if you're in the wrong room, you can leave now, and we won't say anything. In the words of that great theologian, Groucho Marx, before I speak to you this afternoon, I have something important I want to say. I have a story of, not so much a story of grace as a theological word, but a gracious person, and I think that's maybe the way most of us find out about grace, is through someone who's gracious to us. And one of the most gracious and well-known people, I think, is Duke Ellington. I had the opportunity as a reporter for the Arizona Daily Star years ago to interview him. And then I heard him in several places in the country and heard two of his sacred concerts. And there's a story going on among musicians about him, that the reason the band always seemed to be out of tune when they played their theme song, Take the A-Train, was because they got in the last minute, particularly Paul Gonzalez, who always came loaded, and they just sat down and got their horns out of the case when Duke came on and was ready to go. And so they tuned up while playing Take the A-Train. Now, those of us who aren't trained as musicians thought that we couldn't challenge that, because after all, this is the great Duke Ellington, and certainly must be just some exotic arrangement that he had concocted, some discordant version, and it was supposed to be that way. But the truth was that they were out of tune most of the time for Take the A-Train. Maybe some of you have heard him and caught that. Well, there's a story told about when Duke he died about 15 years ago. When he approached St. Peter at the gate, Peter said to him, "You know," and then Peter had already talked and ushered in so many greats like Louis Armstrong and all the others, that he began to talk like them. So he said, "You know, Duke, you were such a beautiful cat back there on earth. We want to do something special for you." He said, "I'm going to give you two wishes, any two things that you'd like to see accomplished on earth." So Ellington thought for a few moments, and he said, "You know, all my life I've tried to express peace among all people, the brotherhood and sisterhood of all." And he said, "I'd like nothing more than to see peace in the Middle East." And Peter said, "What?" He said, "You know, peace in the Middle East." And Peter said, "What are you talking about?" Ellington, very meticulous, said, "Give me a piece of paper." And took a pen, and he drew Israel, and he drew Jordan and the Golan Heights and Syria and over to Iraq and Iran and Kuwait and over there, this side, Egypt. He said, "You know, all these countries to live in everlasting peace." And Peter said, "But they haven't for thousands of years." And Ellington said, "That's my point. That's my wish." And he said, "I don't know." He said, "That's an awful big order." He said, I'm not even sure that top management can handle that." He said, "What's your second wish?" And Ellington said, "Well," he said, "I wish my band would play Take the A-Train in tune once." Peter said, "Let me see that map again." We're going to do a little thinking about grace. Probably means as much to us as any concept in the faith, and it's a word that we've grown up with, particularly Lutherans. We love to bandy it about. And we have different associations. Sometimes we just take it for granted because we've heard it so often. And maybe it's like the word love, too. So think for a moment with me, just as a kind of a meditative introduction to this, what that word means. If you can think of a one-word synonym for it, wonderful. If it takes just a couple of words, fine. No big, long paragraph sentence. Just a couple of catch words, a word that grace means to you. Think of some experience, some gracious person. Whatever connotes grace, what does that word mean to you? Got plenty of chairs.
That's okay.
Are you sure?
That's
you don't
fine,
have to be humble. And you don't play the biblical thing, you know. You sit in the back and get invited to the front. All right. You had a chance to think about that? Let's just jot down a few. I hope you'll all feel free to throw it. Any word goes here. Really.
Forgiveness of sin.
Forgiveness, good.
Loving acceptance. Loving acceptance.
Loving acceptance, fine.
Free gift.
Free gift. Very good.
Just a minute.
Just a minute here. This is my wife Miriam, who spends half her life in front of a blackboard as a teacher. So I thought I'd get a pro here.
Given something you don't deserve.
Something you don't deserve. Can you shorten that?
A sense of giftedness.
Giftedness. There you are. Giftedness. Got a lot of words around gift. That's great. What else?
Unmerited favor.
Okay, anyone else?
I have a friend that has a thing of God's riches at Christ's expense. I think that's what they use.
Oh, God's riches at Christ's expense. That's an interesting, yeah. A lot of theology compacted in that one phrase. Huh? Anyone else?
Pardon.
Pardon, okay. We're going to do some excerpts from Bill Moyer's tape on Amazing Grace. I'm going to try to do the whole thing. I'll just pick out some parts. And there's a scene of convicts in Texas for whom this is the difference between life and death, that song, and why it is. Anyone else? Okay, well, that's a good start. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to look at the other English meaning of the word grace in the sense of gracefulness, a sense of ease and beauty. And that, I think, relates to the other sense of grace as well.
Yeah.
Can I write sense of ease and beauty?
Yeah. Kind of a graciousness. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gracefulness.
Gracefulness. Yeah. I saw a good example of that when Ellington played a concert at San Francisco State. Those of you who are hanging around California know that in the 60s, that time, a real student unrest. And the Black Student Union wanted to be sure, and at those days there was very little awareness of Black history, that this was included in the curriculum. There'd be courses offered in the history of African Americans. And they had to work to get it. Nobody was there to do it, and you know, you had to push like you do with a lot of new things. And it got to be a real showdown, you know, right? And then people got very adamant, locked in their positions, and Professor Hayakawa, remember later Senator Hayakawa, was president of SF State. And so, to make peace, kind of, he invited Duke Ellington. And on the way out, Tony Watkins, his singer, was saying, this is going to be interesting, because he's walking into a red-hot situation. Because there are the crazies on both sides of this thing, and the Ku Kluxers on one side, and some of the Black Power people on the other side, and there's going to be an explosion here, and anything Duke does is going to be wrong. So Hayakawa introduced him with a real flourish. And Ellington just kind of walked out, said a few gracious things, and then they played his Black and Pan Suite and a couple of other things, Liberian Serenade and a few things. And then he just said, well, I reworked my Black and Pan Suite for you, and I'd like to have you hear that. This was when he played it the first time. And he said, I'd like, if I might, to dedicate it to the Black Studies program at San Francisco State. Well, nobody's going to get mad at Duke Ellington for thing he's going to dedicate. Oh, it's just a nice, gracious way of having a delightful concert, making his point in justice, but in a most gracious and graceful way. Okay, let's look at Scripture here. That's where we start. And Genesis Genesis 1, 24 to 31. This is the first story of the creation of human beings. And you know, in the second story, some of us might have a little trouble with that one, because that seems to relegate women to a second category of human beings when God took the rib from Adam, you know. Well, many of us feel maybe the first one is the right one here, and that skips over that kind of gradation, priority business. Somebody read it? Who's got it here?
Good. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the cattle according to their kinds, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a sixth day.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, please.
In that verse 27, when it says male and female, we created them, was that previous to Eve?
This is it.
This is it.
And the second one was where he created, in chapter 2, created Adam first, and then as an afterthought, he said, Adam was lonely, I've got to make a helpmeet for him, as the old King James said. And so he put Adam in a deep sleep, you remember, and took the rib. And some of us might have trouble with that version of it. This one, he's saying he made man, which is really human being. That's what it means. And it quickly tells you it means human being, because it said male and female created he, them, or God created. Okay. How about these concepts and your own ideas, in addition to the ones that are on the board? How does grace appear in this story? Would you say this story could be about grace, and how so? Where do you see grace in here?
The fact of creation.
Creation, yeah, out of nothing.
Yeah.
It actually starts, we pick up the creating of mammals, don't we? Warm-blooded animals. Before that, you know, you go down the chain of life, actually. It follows kind of an interesting progression, an evolutionary progression here. But I picked up with the creation of mammals. And why? Why did God need to bother with this? You know, as God looks back over the years of bloody history to human beings, maybe God has had second thoughts. Maybe God wishes that God had created chimpanzees at the top of the chain. and stopped, he did, but stopped at that. Because chimps wouldn't be building bombs and tearing up the earth like we do. But why? Why this creation? Out of what? Love? Grace? You know? Did God need this? I don't know. If God's complete, then does God need the creation? You say, yeah, God needed people to love, things to love. Maybe so. Maybe God is kind of like a parent in that sense. But anyway, it seems to me it's a kind of free gift here, something that isn't necessarily required. or not required of God. That it's just kind of an idea that God had one nice afternoon and got as far as Holden Village and decided that maybe it would be nice to have human beings here.
But did he have a plan?
Didn't he have a plan? Sure, I suspect there was a plan. But I'm just talking kind of metaphorically here. That, okay, why? How is creation? And it goes right on down to the kind of food we have here, the green plant for food. Why is this grace? Or how is this grace for us? Can grace be every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree with its seed and its fruit, and you shall have them for food. To everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. Infinite provision here. It's an act of grace. What did we do to pay God for that? What did we do to make our creation necessary for God?
It was freely given.
Freely given, yeah. Without any assurance that we're going to do anything worthwhile in response, and many times we don't. And that's the tragedy of the human story. God should give us such freedom that we don't even have to pay any attention to Him. We don't have to thank Him. We can live as though God doesn't exist, the essence of sin. We can simply turn our back on God, go our merry way, which I think most of the world does, and maybe most of us at most of the time even. I think I'm made more conscious up here, but I don't know. Do we live in a graceful relationship in the sense of seeing everything as a gift? Ourselves, what we need for sustenance. And so in the very beginning, it's talking about a gift. It's talking about grace. It's not talking about quid pro quo, you do this and I'll do that. It's not talking about God expecting something in return. He did. He certainly hasn't gotten much back, I don't think. Some things, of course. And all of us have our moments, and certainly history is replete with people who have lived their life in obedience to God. Well, grace as creation, the very sustenance of life, the very pure air that we breathe up here, the very good food that we eat, our bodies. If we had to remind our hearts to beat, I'm sure I wouldn't get out of the house in the morning. And I'd fall dead many times during the day. I mean, there'd be no way I could keep reminding myself that my heart should beat, or that my blood should circulate and purify my body and bring oxygen in and carry the waste away. All of those things that go on without our even thinking of it. Tell ourselves to digest our food. We even move almost instinctively without, we think about moving and we move, but we don't think about the fact we're thinking about it. We just do it. And we don't make a conscious action. We don't say to ourselves, now I've got to put my left foot ahead of my right foot, and then I've got to put the right foot up and da da da. We just do it. Grace as creation. Creation as giftedness, as a free gift, something we don't deserve, unmerited favor, pardon, we'll get into more of those. Sympathies and beauty, appreciation of the gift of creation. Anyone else have a thought on this? Creation is a gift. and his grace. Okay, let's turn to a very familiar story about his son, Luke 15, 11. We know that story so well, I think we might just summarize it. Particularly after the young man had realized his folly, and he says, "I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy," this is verse 19, "to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." Repentance, a change of heart. He rose and came to his father, but while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven." It starts with a sin against God. "And before you, I am no longer worthy to be called your son." And you know what the father said, "Bring the best robe and kill the fat calf," and so forth. And you know the brother's very understandable response, that he had been faithful to his father and done the job and stayed home, took care of the farm, the ranch. And now all this fuss was being made for the son who had come back and who had even proved himself. You know, we talk about the work ethic, which we all believe in. Wouldn't the father have been completely justified in saying, "Talk is cheap. You know, talk is cheap. You've blown it. I think you ought to start, you know, working out in the field, just like any other hired hand." And the son said he was willing to do that. "Let's try that for a while, son. And then when you work yourself into some kind of a state, and I'm convinced that you really mean this, then we can talk about your role as son, restoring you to your sonship." Wouldn't that have been reasonable? Wouldn't that have been pretty good parenting? I think Ann Landers would have gone along with that, don't you? I mean, that makes sense. I mean, I think some of us even said that about our kids, you know, said, "Hey, you gotta do something for yourself. You know, you can't just come here and flop and crash and then go on for the next thing. Somewhere you've got to prove that you're serious." If that had been his response, he could have said, "I love you, son, but I want you to do something for yourself first before you ask me to do something." Wouldn't that have been a reasonable response, even a loving response? Common sense, huh? Well, every parable really is against common sense. This is not a parable about the best kind of parenting. Not a parable about justice. Certainly not about justice. It's not a parable about what most fathers ought to do. It's not instructing us. It's simply a parable about grace. Jesus had one meaning to his parables, and they all seem to come funneling into grace. The unexpected, undeserved, unmerited, surprising love of God. The love that comes to us when we least deserve it. Have not proven ourselves yet. Could blow it again tomorrow. And God's like somebody addicted to gambling and goes to Las Vegas and keeps playing the same old numbers, knowing that those numbers haven't worked before. And God still plays the numbers, still hangs there, hangs in with us, gives us time and time again a new chance. He doesn't wait for us to prove it first, that we're worthy of it, to show him that we've changed, you know. What's your thought about it? Anything that comes to your mind?
I've always heard that God loved us with a love that's so great that we can't understand it or comprehend it.
Mysterious love of God.
And so great and far beyond what we can comprehend.
Right. Anyone else?
As the prodigal son is showing us that he works with us as individuals. And this wasn't grace toward his other son, but it was to the one who was lost.
Yeah, and you know, he did say to his other son, you know, you've been with me, and what I have is yours. And so he tried to placate or at least explain to his son how he felt about the younger son returning.
I find it strange how the other son knew what the younger son had been up to if he'd been away for such a long time.
Yeah.
You know, how come he knew what he'd been up to?
How
come he knew what the other son had been up to? If the other son had been away for such a long time, the older brother seemed to know what he'd been doing.
Oh, with the younger? Yeah. Well, it doesn't read between the lines. Maybe they had a conversation up the pathway or something.
Well, he said in 24, for this, my son was dead and alive again. He was lost now in town. So he was being sent back.
Yeah, in the Amazing Grace, I once was lost, but now I'm found. Mm-hmm. Was blind, but now I see.
Otherwise, you've been lost forever.
Okay, well, it's...
Many have labeled us the waiting father rather than the prodigal son.
Yeah, right, yes.
The accent is on the grace of the father.
Yes, yes.
Not on the misdeeds of the son.
That's right.
So...
Yeah, right.
The waiting parent.
The waiting father. It's always a problem, or I think a danger to allegorize these things. I don't think they're meant that way, really. But maybe you can take some liberty and say about the text, at least it says about the father. We're asking the question about how do we deal with a rebellious child. And this isn't primarily about that. But one insight would be that the father waited for the son to return. He didn't go out chasing after him. It's kind of interesting. I don't know. Maybe he didn't know where he was. Maybe he wanted some to let the son get to the place where he knew that there was no other answer than grace. Does that have any correspondence with us? Does God have to let us kind of stumble and fall?
God never coerces us.
Pardon?
God never coerces us.
Never coerces us.
He tests us.
What do you think about that? Has God ever...
He tests us and we go through a lot of things because of our rebellion.
A friend of mine talks about the shyness of God. He gets a little angry, too. He thinks God's too shy. He thinks God ought to be a little more assertive. Get in there and pull us in. Straighten us out. Warn us. Stepping off the end of a cliff. Why doesn't God holler out? A lot of freedom.
Given us the power to choose.
Power to choose. Well, it gets into the whole mystery of evil. And why do we have such total and complete freedom at times? We couldn't choose evil, could we choose good? Sort of buying.
Yeah, a Jewish social worker asked me once why God allowed 6 million Jews to die.
Yeah.
She didn't understand that.
Allowed who?
The 6 million to die in the house.
Elie Wiesel, who was a boy of, I think, about 12, 14 years old when he was thrown in the concentration camp, his parents. And I believe he actually saw this, or it was reported to him, but when the train pulled up at Auschwitz, the newly arrived people were getting out. They weren't welcome like we were, but with cattle prods and guns and whatever else to herd. We herded like animals into barracks before they were thrown into the gas ovens. But he said that a 10 years old was taken up on the gallows as this new train load arrived in the boxcars. And then they sprung him, and the trap went out from under his feet, and the boy wreathed and twisted there, not heavy enough to snap his neck and just strangled. And Wiesel said, somebody said behind him, "Ah, where is your God now? Angry." And somebody else quietly said, "There he is, on the gallows." You don't have to be an Orthodox Christian to preach the gospel or be an agent of God's grace. If we limit ourselves to just Lutheran pipelines, or Methodist, or whatever, I think we're in trouble. Or even just Christian pipelines. Can't God speak through all kinds of people? And if he can't get through some of us Orthodox types who maybe take grace for granted because we've heard the word and it's worn smooth for us, he has to use anybody that he can, any moment, any situation, to announce what grace is to the rest of us. And if you're anything like me, it's I've been a Lutheran for all these years, and I'm glad I am. It's hard, though, not to become complacent, take it for granted, and use the word without the richness and depth and struggle that that word involves, and the graciousness with which God comes to us, unexpected, undeserved, unannounced.
Isn't that part of the beauty of grace, though, being so casual about it?
Casual.
I mean, we take it for granted because it's almost because of the freedom of it.
It's almost too good to be true.
But it's there. I mean, we have it. So it's, I think part of the beauty is taking it for granted. And that's not meant in a negative sense, but it's...
Yeah, well, I see what you mean. Anybody else want to amplify on that?
I think that's missing out of that list that we made. Those are all sort of remedies. That grace is a remedy for something that's wrong. And I think it's important that grace is more than just a remedy. It's also something that, because we can count on it, can allow us to take risks. Can be a motivator for action. It's not simply something that fixes what's wrong, but it's something that allows us to do what's right, and sometimes to mess up, because if you know that there's grace and forgiveness, you can try something. If you don't know that, you're paralyzed for fear of doing something wrong. And so if we think of that first passage that you had us look at in Genesis, since one of the ways grace is there, it's in the phrase, in the image of God, that here we have a God who is a creator who makes us in that image. And Dorothy Sayers has said that the primary characteristic of God in Genesis 1 is that God is creative. If we're made in the image of God, then we too create. That's an action that that you can't do if you're afraid of messing up. If you're afraid that, oh, I'm going to ruin this paper, then you can't paint.
Right.
Children take their parents for granted, I think. They've got, in many cases, a healthy relationship. The parents are always there. They don't think about why their parents are there or why their parents care and love them. And the parent is gone, but something disrupts that, then the concern is there. I think that's the same with grace. We take it for granted because it's there, we know it's there. And if we're jerked out from under us, or somebody shook our mental process up about it, then it would.
Yeah, and maybe what is subconscious and there, as you say, needs at some point, I need to be reminded, confronted. Isn't that what preaching and the sacrament is about, you know, to remind us? So we know pretty much what the preacher is going to say or ought to say. And we certainly know what the communion is saying to us. But we need to be reminded of it, you know. And it's to lift up into our consciousness so that when we come to the place, you know, we'll talk about that later in the week, through many dangers, trials, toils, and snares. Many of the dangers, trials, and snares, we've been going back and over which word it is. Then we need to sometimes be reminded by someone there is grace available. And it isn't after we've straightened things out, then we can come to God. But it's before Unconditional.
Does that help you through periods of persecution? It seems like this wave of anti-Christian, anti-Christ spirit that's rising in this country is going to lead to a persecution of the Christian in the years to come. And you have to be strong in your faith, I guess, to stand on the word, because we've never had persecution of Christians in this country. We've never had wars here. And how will we all, will we need the grace to withstand the onslaught? I think it's
going to
get really...
Yeah, I wonder, though, if some... I have been persecuted as a Christian. It's been part of my normal society, people I know and love and support. But I'm thinking of where somebody takes a stand that's unpopular and may well be the prophetic word for us. Martin Luther King. There was a person who was more than scorned at. What would it be if you took a very unpopular stand in your church, whatever that may be? Isn't always easy. Some of you have maybe run into a few times. Got singed, maybe? Yep.
Persecuted is kind of a strong word.
Persecuted is a strong word. I don't like that word. It's too strong.
For our time, that's how I think it can be subtle. You can feel really hurt from someone who...
It's not an easy world for people who want to have their faith affirmed wherever they turn. I just got back from it's a kind of a traumatic place in life. I don't know if any of you reached it yet, but back to your 50th high school reunion. All those old people, I mean, that's not me, that's all those old guys.
That's the rest of it.
They were probably a few years ahead of you.
Well, whatever. Anyway, we had a luncheon on Friday before the big bash on Saturday night. Before the men, they had a sexist their luncheon, and then the women had their luncheon too. So we men had ours. And the class treasurer was telling me about it. He said, tell me what to do. He says, one guy, I'm a little worried about what he's going to say. And I didn't know what he'd say either. I hadn't seen the guy for years. He used to be a guy who walked home from school with a fairly close friend. And so, sure enough, he got up and he popped off and he hammered the crack. I'm not even going to tell you. Such a kind of raunchy joke at the expense of ministers. And I suppose he thought, you know, well, good old Bob, I know him. But that wasn't bad. That's fine. We're fair game. We asked for it. What was really interesting, and not so much the blue nose response at all, but it's a question of what do 68-year-old guys do when they get together for lunch? And they don't know if they're going to see any of those guys again. And they've just known that a few of them had kicked off in the last few months. And some of them, you know, going to the doctor with some ominous things already. And the old bod doesn't respond. And the jock, you know, one of the big ones in class, has to run around and talk about his state high school record, which still stands, 20-yard low hurdles and 110-yard high, still stands after 50 years. The thing he doesn't tell you is that a couple of years after he graduated, they changed it over to meters. So these guys have whipped his record all over the map, you know, but it's in meters, so he can still claim he's got the record in yards. Ray Tharp from Washburn High.
You remember
Ray? Yeah, who went to Roosevelt? You must have remembered, yeah.
He made the record.
Oh. Sure he did. Sure.
Carlton Stadium, I think.
Sure.
I
knew Ray.
It's being recorded for posterity.
There you are. Oh, sure. And I used to run around the mile when they put the mile in, and that janitor waited for me to finish so he'd close up the stadium. Anyway. So what do you do, these old duffers, see, these guys? And I think there is something unspoken. And I think it's got something to do with grace. But I don't know how to articulate it at a luncheon like that. I didn't even try, really. We went around the room, and everybody, after one guy started off setting the pace, which the treasurer of the class was concerned about, and began a series about every second or third person had to tell a raunchy joke. And they had to see if they could get raunchier than the next guy. Now this was our luncheon, and we were there to introduce ourselves and say something about what we'd done. That was the best we could do for most of the class, I think. It's kind of sad, I thought. Not, you know, see, I'm not talking in terms of whether you like your taste isn't the issue. It's sort of how do people face their demise? How do they face, as Paul Tillich used to say, non-being? Joe Sittler, who's spoken here, some of you know the name, used to worry a lot about this, and he had a very long and agonizing death, which was really ironic because he worried a lot about that maybe happening to him. And I asked him one time what really bothered him the most. He said, well, it's a dying process, not dying so much. But he said, dying seemed like he put it a hell of a waste. You know, he thought he still had something to contribute, and I'm sure he did. So how do you face it? Well, that's the way the class of 42 washmen saw it. I'm not sure we did.
Sure we did. Too bad we can't think of life more as a journey than as demise.
Demise, yeah. Yeah, right. So the death is built in as part of the journey. Yeah, maybe the old-fashioned way, you know, talking about it as your journey. I think people were not as pathological about death. I don't know for sure. I lived in those days. Okay, let's look at another one here, unless you got a little more on this. Let's look at Luke 10, 25 to 37. Anybody want to read that? You all know this story very well.
That was a scripture yesterday.
That was a scripture. All right, let's just pick it up here. The preacher, how many were you all at Vespers? Checking on the people. Okay. I thought that sermon was excellent. And I could feel for little Lucille Wilson.
Yeah.
I never had quite the traumatic accident she did, but I felt almost like I did at times. And felt, you know, out of step and sort of a klutz. And I really felt for her. And the way he told it, I thought he had a real understanding of that. In fact, that he remembered it so well. But he did say one thing that I think a lot of us have thought about. Again, sermons being reminders of what we already know. That maybe we could look at the Good Samaritan as Jesus. And if that's so, let's just suppose for a moment we can do that. And what do we see about grace? What is the story? And you know the background. The Good Samaritan was like, I suppose, a black person in the most hostile environment in the north or the south, where they're not respected, not wanted, cast out, defined by the color of their skin and not by anything else. All those things that happen. Samaritans were the despised people. Rest of the Israelites would not even build the temple with them. They had a separate temple. The Samaritan shadow went across your food, you didn't eat it, and so on and so forth. This utter, another category of human beings, dehumanizing people. And remember, this guy going by was asking for trouble with the Samaritan. What if the guy died? Would he be blamed for it? A Samaritan would be immediately suspect. You know, you messed up. That's a Samaritan for you. And, you know, he took his life in his hands doing it. And then there's a ceremonial thing that if he died, then he's got to go through a whole bunch of ritualistic purification. Malpractice insurance in those days. But he stopped. He took a lot of risk. What if it was a setup? But this guy's a plant. And his buddies are hiding behind the bushes, and this guy stops and bends over. Boom, we get him. Or what if the Samaritan rises up with a knife and sticks it in your chest? I mean, not the Samaritan, the traveler. Some rest here. And if Jesus is a good Samaritan, as our preacher suggested, it's one way of looking at the story, what do we learn about grace from that story?
It's extended toward everyone.
Extended to everyone. Was it based on merit? Anything that the by the way, the only one that's not identified here is the traveler, isn't it? We don't know what race or religion he was.
Well, we're all made in the image and likeness of God. We all have a soul, so how can there be any difference in anybody?
Yeah.
I mean, we're all the same in the eyes of God.
It'd be nice if we acted on that premise, wouldn't it?
Number two up there, kind of goes to loving acceptance.
All right. How's that? Did the traveler necessarily deserve to be helped? Supposing he was a part of the majority that despised the Samaritans.
Right.
Yeah.
Chapter before, Jesus sent his messengers into Samaria, and they were rejected, and they were considered outside the Israel of faith, and sort of heretics, and mixed blood, and all that. And for him to make the hero of the story, kind of the enemy, is
kind of went out of his way.
Was the priest and the Levite mentioned in this parallel to the story? Comparable to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, described, were they the same in the same?
The religious establishment, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would have felt them.
The pastors, I'm sure. The president of the council. Whatever.
I mean, you couldn't tell by looking at somebody what class they were in, could you?
They wore robes, yeah, they wore ceremonial garb. Yeah, the Levites had on garb, distinguishing them from the Sadducees or the Pharisees.
Clarence Jordan said the priest was going to make a guest sermon on compassion. He didn't have time to stop.
That's right.
That's right. I was going to pick up on that word compassion, too. It was compassion that was the overriding principle here. And that was the theme of the parable, because of the compassion that he had. That in spite of things, the risk factor and the threat to his own health or to his own reputation, the principle was compassion.
Yeah, right. Well, it's like the parables of Jesus and Jesus' own way of conducting his life. He's always pulling some kind of a surprise, some kind of a offbeat way of looking at a situation. Bringing out the hidden meaning and things. I think the Samaritan would have been perfectly justified in terms of the risks involved and the mores of the day and the way Samaritans were treated to have gone right on by, just like the priest and Levite. Probably more reason to go by.
I wonder if sometimes people who are persecuted are more compassionate. The rest of the community gets kind of haughty,
Is that your experience? Yeah, that's an interesting idea. Think of people who have been very compassionate toward you. Were they people who, some of them suffered a great deal themselves and could empathize with you more?
That speaks to me of some of the people I've heard speak from South Africa. You know, Tutu and some of them, when they talk about the whites, there's not hate there, there's compassion there, and that to me is remarkable.
Yeah. And King said the battle was for black people's bodies and white people's souls. He was concerned about what this does to us. We think of it that being a racist is something that's bad for the reciprocant, the recipient of that. But how about those of us who are in the position of power? I mean, we may not be Ku Klux Klanners or anything near it, but just the fact that we have power over someone because of an accident of our birth. Because of something that we didn't design for ourselves. Just happened. Okay, you got a guy going out of his way, taking a risk, extending compassion and going through a lot of inconvenience to do it, bringing him to the inn and told him to take care of him. And if he needs further help, I'll repay you when I come back. So he's following through on it. It's not just getting rid of the guy. We get a number of panhandlers in our neighborhood, and I Palo Alto, they're upward mobile panhandlers. And got good taste. And I don't know what to do. I still don't know what to do. I live in the inner city and, you know, been around the cities like you have, and I don't know the answer. So out of guilt, many times I'll reach in and give them something. But a lot of times I don't know, because I think if I want to do something, I ought to spend the time trying to figure out why that person's on the street. And I have a couple of times. It's a long and bound story. And if you cut through all the guff and find out what it is, I don't know if it can help, but there are people out there who are definitely people who have been decimated by life. They're not all just out there because they like to sleep on the streets or they're lazy, by any means. So what do you do with it? You know, the stranger. I don't have an answer, but this guy did. I mean, he was willing to take all those risks. He could have said, hey, that's a wino. He's asked for it. Look at him down there in the gutter. Let him take care of himself. He didn't know from just passing by whether he had been beaten up or whether he had fallen down drunk.
Is it true the priest and the Levite, that they were not supposed to go near any dead bodies?
Well, if the person died in their care, then they're ceremonially unclean. I don't know if there's a prohibition against helping somebody, but that threat.
But they would at least take a risk if the man had died.
Yeah, and if they were busy having to get to the church on time, you know, whatever else, get to the council meeting, the stewardship meeting.
Ladies' circle.
Maybe what?
The ladies' circle.
The ladies' circle. Yeah, we don't say that, you know, maybe that was a woman Pharisee. Probably not, because...
Probably not.
But it could have been that women can be Pharisees, too. Well, I think, you know, if you can see these parables as illustrations of grace. Jesus has got one point here in a parable, and it's really about grace. We get through it a little different variations, but grace. God's doing something by surprise. It's not deserved or expected, or it's not part of the contract. It doesn't come with the territory. Not something that you can figure out that makes good common sense. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us to take that kind of risk. We'd say, go on down to the next filling station and call a camel patrol and have them come up. You know, do something else. Wait for somebody to help you. But don't take that risk yourself.
Didn't Jesus say that whatever we do in this life, when we die and we stand in front of God the next minute, we're going to be accountable for everything we did do and we didn't do in this life?
We don't like to talk about Ellington Church. We don't like to talk about judgments. No, yeah, you're right. What if everybody? What if God's taping everything I say all my life? Grief. Gonna play all that back to me someday? That would be hell. I'd have to listen to all that.
But you had a chance to help, and you didn't help. And he told you to help, and you didn't help.
Okay, but what? All right, that's true, and I agree. But then, what has grace got to say about the next situation comes up with, maybe before I get to the lunch hall or something? What does it say? Because I've been hard-nosed and selfish and indifferent, will I always have to be that way?
No, if you tell him you're sorry, he'll forgive you. But he always gives you another chance. If you're just not proud and arrogant and stubborn.
Pride kind of his original sin or part of it? Well, I think it's saying, yeah, you don't always have to be what you set out to be. You can change. With the grace of God, you change. There's help. There's hope for us all. And that's what the alcoholic comes to in the Alcoholic Anonymous. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol. And I surrender my life to a higher power. Very Christian in its steps for salvation. holds. And interestingly enough, it carries a wide variety of religious, it's a very inclusive kind of thing. I had a friend who said he'd been a Lutheran all his life, but he really had to become an alcoholic to just do it. Yeah. What grace meant. Okay, anybody else got a thought about this one? Well, here's another doozy for you. This one is even more strange than the others, and that's Matthew 20. This one describes any kind of labor relations types. Anybody believes in justice for the worker, just right through the wall. I don't have the wall. Just, okay, I'd like to read part. Let's see, it's 10.
I'll read it.
Okay, why don't you?
Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the householders, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to go give to this last as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me, or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first last.
What do you think about that in terms of grace? Mm-hmm. Is this a parable about justice? Is that just to pay the last guy who works 1 hour the same as the guy who's been working the whole day? Is that just? Mm-hmm. It certainly isn't a way to increase the morale among your workers.
But probably I'll be working 1 hour.
That's right, we'll all show up at the last hour. You got it. They'd all figure that one out pretty fast.
Maybe the door will close before
The door will close before you get there. Okay, well where's the grace in this one? See anything about grace?
The last line about begrudging, you begrudge my generosity.
You begrudge my generosity.
The bottom line is, again, the foolishness of the nature of God, that he doesn't know how what good parenting is.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't, you know, the risk taking and so on, to emulate risk taking, that is absolutely foolish, foolhardy. And you're saying about the giving a credit card at the end, any other expenses, here's my credit card.
Yeah.
You know, who would do those things?
I know it.
You know, they're ridiculous, and so with this, it's absolutely foolish.
But well,
it's generous.
Think about it. One little, there's no assignment here. There's no law saying you got to do something about grace. I think it might be kind of fun, though, if you want to come back at all, is to think, as you move around on the next day or two, of some observation you make, somebody come out of the kitchen, something doing something that you think that was a gracious gesture. Or you hear a word of encouragement or grace. Something kind of unexpected. Or maybe you hear those words and you don't think about it. Or you see somebody and maybe you even provide a lonely person with some kind of companionship. So think about it. See if you can identify some moments of grace right among us here. You have to give names. Thanks for coming. Thank you.